AMC Entertainment. Set to report second quarter results after the bell today. And joining us now to discuss what to expect is Chad Bynum. He's Macquarie Group Senior Analyst. Chad, in as much as the numbers matter to the diehards for AMC, let's talk about what to expect here. As Brian Sazzi mentioned earlier, Cinemark reported late last week, and perhaps we can extrapolate some encouraging things for AMC. What is your outlook?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Julie. So a couple of the highlights you talked about from Cinemark and then also a few of the other chains that have released second quarter earnings. What we saw was revenues were generally off roughly 70% versus the two-year comparable period back in Q2 2019. However, the big positive for everybody was actually an opportunity to break even on cash flow. And that's what we saw from Cinemark, from Marcus. IMAX was another company, a little bit of a different business model. But again, they're burning less cash or actually no cash, which is positive going forward. But on the core fundamentals, you know, clearly we're seeing lower demand for movies that are coming out. That was evidenced this weekend with Suicide Squad, which came in a little bit below expectations. For the back half of the year, we were expecting that U.S. admission revenues would be off somewhere between 10 and 25%. We've brought down our estimate, and then that brings down our estimate for 2022.
Chad, do these companies, AMC, Cinemark, do they still have that access to capital they need potentially later this year?
You know, I think AMC was able to address some of these issues in the last quarter. They'll talk about that tonight on the earnings call. They still have significant amount of deferred rent that they will have to pay. You know, these weren't debt forgiveness rental agreements. But yeah, currently they have some cash on the balance sheet. They'll burn less. I don't know if they'll be able to access the markets as they were in the first and second quarter, just given, you know, what happened with the proxy and the lack of options for AMC.
Out of all the main theater chains, you see some of the stocks we're showing on the screen, AMC, Cinemark, IMAX, National CineMedia. Is there one theater chain that you're concerned that may not survive this?
You know, from a margin perspective, IMAX is a very asset-light business model. They have a clean balance sheet. They're in the best position. They have global diversification. That stock has been hampered just with what's going on in China from a headline standpoint. Cinemark, on the traditional exhibitor space, they were generating 25% margins pre-pandemic. When we talked to them on Friday, they actually said they still believe they can get back to those levels. They have very low cost in terms of utilities, labor, wages, et cetera. And they're more outside of urban markets. AMC is always the one just because their rent is extremely high. You know, their center city, New York, LA, Chicago, some of these bigger markets. And it's just going to be harder for them to generate positive margin and positive free cash flow.
And, you know, Chad, thinking about just the general setup for the movie business, I mean, we heard a very different, you know, tone from Viacom last week when they came out with their results, trying to be very, we talked to the CFO on the program, I thought they were trying to be extremely explicit in their talent friendliness, let's say, relative to some other brands that we'll hear from later this week. Have we maybe underrated the shift that's happened, though, with the distribution of movies during the pandemic? And have we opened a Pandora's box here, to use kind of the industry's phrase? And is that maybe not being reflected in some of the theater chains, you know, quite as much as it ought to be?
I think we can't be naive in the conversation around theatrical windows. We won't go back to 3 to 4 months. You know, pre-pandemic, the average was about a 75-day window at the theater versus at the home. Now it's certainly coming in somewhere between the 30 and 45 days. I think all the studios believe that this is the correct model. They still do believe that, you know, there is something that is created and generated at the theater. But a consumer, they want things now. They can't wait 3 or 4 months like maybe they would years ago. So they've had to adjust. And I think that's just something that we're going to have to live with. And, you know, with the day and date releases, as we've seen with some of these movies, that's going to be a very tricky situation, because, you know, like we saw with Scarlett Johansson, a lot of the artistic and financial you know, benefits that come in the industry aren't being rewarded like they were in the prior business model.
And Chad, I wanted to ask about Suicide Squad because it did not meet its projections in the theaters over the weekend. And what are we to take away from that? Are we to take away that people are worried about the Delta variant and there are some bigger implications for the theater business? Is it just because of this movie? What's your takeaway?
Yeah, I think you know, we had lowered expectations as a result of mask compliance and the Delta variant, but this did come in below, to your point. Part of it may have been as a result of prior reviews on, you know, the predecessor movie. Part of it, I think, was probably the Delta variant. It's really, you know, it's tough to tell. I think we were seeing some good momentum in the movie theater going business. We're seeing that with premium content, premium showings. That's resulting in good ticket prices and really a movement towards IMAX or premium type showing. So we were, you know, slightly optimistic that this could come in above expectations. It's really the romantic comedies and some of those lower budget movies. Those are going to take a lot longer to recover. But, you know, this is certainly hurting the names. I think that's one of the reasons why the stocks are down today. They all sold off hard in July when the reopening names sold off. And I think this will put pressure on them for the next month or so.
Hey, Chad, we've been sort of joking this morning about our own market research we've been conducting on different topics. Have you been going to the movies? What have you been seeing? What have you been noticing? Are people buying more drinks, less? I mean, what's happening out there?
I personally haven't gone back to the movies yet, just given the approach that my family is taking. You know, I think it's a tricky one because the numbers that we're seeing clearly show that there's no price elasticity. There's people that want to go do, you know, lots of things, whether it's vacationing or going out to restaurants or going to the movies, and the operators can charge whatever. And those people who want to go are going to continue to go. So we're seeing really strong pricing, but the attendance is still well off of prior levels. You do have a slew of differentiated content that comes out in the next couple months. That'll probably get me, you know, back into that environment. But, you know, we've always said the movie theater is a place where kids can escape parents and parents can escape kids. And I think parents right now aren't choosing to escape their kids, get a babysitter, and go to the movies. They're doing other things that maybe they weren't able to do, you know, during the past 18 months. And this has kind of been pushed back in the priority scale.
And to your point, there's also, of course, safety concerns about bringing it home to your kids. So it's telling that in itself is market research that you are not there yet. And I think a lot of people are in the same boat. Chad Vinen, yeah. Good to see you. Macquarie Group Senior Analyst, thanks for being here.
Alternative asset manager Blue Owl is on the prowl for some slam dunks, recently taking a 5% stake in the Sacramento Kings. Let's see what else the newly created money manager has cooking. Joining us now is Blue Owl co-founder and co-president Mark Lipschultz and co-president Michael Reese. Good morning to you both here. Mark, let me start with you. Certainly catching a lot of attention with that new investment in the Sacramento Kings. Why'd you make that play?
Well, listen, thank you so much for having us this morning. Really a pleasure to be here. I'm going to actually turn that to my partner and friend Michael here.
Yeah, thank you. We're really excited about our strategy we call Home Court, which is our joint venture with the NBA. We have two early positions, one in the Phoenix Suns and the other, you referenced, the Sacramento Kings. And it gives our investors a way at a smaller denomination to participate in the growth and excitement that the league offers from an investment perspective.
So, Michael, how do they earn a return on this stake?
Well, we've seen a tremendous increase in value of the overall sports and media industry. Investors in our funds are able to participate in both the cash flow dynamics that the league offers, as well as the long-term appreciation. You invest in the fund, and at some point, you have the right to exit and get the appreciation that your position has achieved over that period of time.
And Mark, it's Miles here. I'd love if we could maybe just back up and talk a little bit about the structure here of this company and the structure of the SPAC transaction and sort of how it fits into this conversation around SPACs. I mean, I think us here in the media, we kind of paint it all as, you know, one big thing, but certainly within that space, you know, it's just a structure and there's a lot of opportunities in there. And I'm curious, you know, how you guys see yourselves fitting into that.
That's a fantastic and perceptive question. You know, the SPAC is itself just a structure, as you said. And for us, frankly, it offered a really critical structural tool to achieve the strategic end. The mission for us was to bring together the direct lending business of Owl Rock with the GP Capital Solutions business of Dyal and bring those two together. And to do that, we needed to have a vehicle, as you say, a structure, and the SPAC served as that structure. Sitting here today, we're just like any other public company that has gone through an IPO. The SPAC was quite small as a portion of our capital structure. And so today we're a publicly traded company, and that happened to have been the mechanical way for us to become the one-stop shop for capital solutions for the alternatives industry.
And so it's Julie here. What does that mean exactly for folks out there who are not necessarily familiar, right? When you talk about alternatives, alternative assets, I know part of your business is direct lending. The other is alternatives like the stake, the MBA stakes that you were talking about. What are some of the other, what's sort of the breakdown of the portfolio, if you will?
Well, Julie, think about the overall alternatives industry as a growth industry. And it needs capital to grow in a number of different ways. And you mentioned direct lending. We have one of the leading platforms for making loans at the portfolio company level. But we also have additional pools of capital to buy into the firms at their GP level, at the management company level, and to lend to those firms as well. So we want to be the provider of picks and shovels to the alternatives industry, not doing the deals directly, but as I said, providing the capital that they need to accomplish their objectives, whether it's across the buyout space, infrastructure, real estate, et cetera. Well, we have pools of capital to meet all those needs.
Mark, I was I talked last week to one of your competitors, Apollo, and they told me they remain long the United States. Are you still long the U.S. despite all the concerns we're seeing about peak growth, COVID variant, you name it?
We certainly are. The U.S. economy continues to be extremely strong. You know, we see this through it. We have hundreds of companies in our portfolio. So we have an interesting lens into it and heavily U.S.-centric into that picture. And businesses are thriving, and there's certainly challenges. Inflationary pressures are very real. The wage issues and achieving, finding workers is certainly a challenge, but the businesses are really doing well. We have a particular focus as a firm on lending capital to the technology sector. And as I think is apparent to everyone, this is an area of tremendous growth that is thriving. And I think there's little reason to think it's going to slow down.
It's interesting to hear you guys talk about the growth there, because when you hear from the traditional banks, when they reported their numbers, lending was pretty lackluster. That was one of the areas where they were just not seeing a lot of demand. So what's different with the clients to whom you're lending versus what a traditional bank might see?
Yeah, that, so here's the reason our business exists, which is to provide capital to mid-size, upper middle market, in our parlance, businesses that are growing. And that is really an area the banks no longer focus on. We make loans and hold those loans. So we have long dated. In fact, in the case of Blue Owl, over 90% of our capital is permanent capital. This is a really important attribute of our business, but it's really important as it relates to our ability to deliver capital. So we keep our capital. We can provide very long dated solutions or very tailored short dated solutions to these companies that really aren't served by the banks anymore. And just like banking of old, where loans used to be made and then retained by the bank, and there was a relationship between the bank and the borrower, and it was about mutual success, that's really what we've brought back to the picture. And with private equity in particular driving a lot of borrowing, we really have never, we in fact have never been busier. We've had our busiest quarter ever in terms of loan origination.
And Michael, back to you on sports. How big do you envision that part of the portfolio getting, and how far away are you from another deal?
Well, the overall industry has been dominated by individual investors, and we all know the names that own the teams across all different leagues. This is really the very beginning of the process for institutions and more retail investors to have their ability to access this. So it's really early days. The institutional investment in sports is just getting started. And we think it could be quite substantial over time.
Well, we look forward to following your journey. Blue Owl co-founder and co-president Mark Lipschultz and co-president Michael Reese, good to see you guys. Have a great week.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, the battle to secure studio and sound space in Hollywood has gotten more intense as streamers, including the likes of Apple and Netflix, compete to return to spending money on production. It's been a big boost. The businesses for the likes of real estate investment trusts focus on that space, including the likes of Hudson Pacific Properties, a REIT with a portfolio of office and studio properties totaling nearly 20 million square feet. The company, along with Blackstone, recently announced plans to add to that a collection of spaces with a 240,000 square foot project, which boasts a 7 film and TV ready sound stages. And for more on that, happy to welcome into the program the CEO of Hudson Pacific, Victor Coleman, here with us. And Victor, I mean, we've seen this push really kind of intensifying in the recovery here in the pandemic. I mean, talk to me about why building this out now and what you're expecting to see there.
Well, great to be here, Zach. Thank you. The push is really based on a content drive. And it was a show-to-show business for many, many years. And now it's, you know, obviously credit-rated companies from the old guard studios all the way to the new streaming companies that all need access to space, both domestically here in the United States and other places around the world. And, you know, obviously Hollywood is still the king of entertainment. And as a result, Los Angeles is a driver. We've not seen new studios built in a long time, and the demand is as high as it's ever been.
Yeah, and I mean, in regards to that, I assume it would make your guys' job easier if you do have, as you said, better rated companies coming in here and trying to use the spaces and how that all looks. But I mean, when it comes to the demand that you've seen increase as production has come on, give me a sense of how quickly it's bounced back and what you're expecting to see.
Well, as you well know, I mean, early on in the pandemic, content was zero in terms of the production. And then they ramped it up late last summer, almost a year ago now. It was August of last year that they started ramping it up. And so they basically have, you know, almost a full year of backlog that they got to get out on the content side. And, you know, we're talking almost $100 billion of content creation that is going to be coming out to the marketplace over a 12-month period. And that is up precipitously since the prior years. And then you've got, as I said, a backlog of 6 to 12 months of production at the same time. And so this is going to be going for the next few years at least. You're going to see a lot of dollars put out and a lot of production streaming through all different content players.
Yeah, I mentioned the expansion plans there in LA, but when you think about where else you could be expanding, you mentioned expansion plans in the UK, other areas of production. I mean, what are you seeing in terms of how much effort's going to be placed into those projects and I guess the early fruit?
So listen, I think that there's key markets that are very, very sticky in the production world. And those are, as we mentioned, Los Angeles or New York, it's Vancouver, it's Toronto, it's the UK. And then there's second tier markets that are going to be driven based on tax incentives or aspects around that. And as a result, you're going to find people are going to gravitate to longer term leasing and longer term productions in those key markets. And then shorter term, which is more feature films or individual series, it's some of the second tier markets. But right now, I mean, the demand is so high, people are looking to anywhere they can get production, content, and the talent around that, which is key because talent is everything, you know, both in front and behind the camera.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the tax benefit side, too. We had, the state assemblyman behind the push here to kind of keep those tax advantages there in Hollywood. We've talked about, other places that have popped up for production, including Georgia and other states as well. I mean, how do you guys follow those things in terms of where you should be building some of these projects? And how do you see that shaping up as the competition there, not just on the studio side of companies trying to find the best places to film and the best talent, as you're talking about, but also best tax incentives on the likes of where you should be building these projects?
Well, you know, we're looking for purpose-built facilities. So this is going to be a long-term facility for us, both in California and the UK and the other ones that we're building around in our core markets. So tax incentives are great on the construction side, which California just put into place, which was that new bill that you just referred to, on both the construction and then also on the production side. But, you know, you're looking at when I call purpose-built, this is quality real estate for long-term, production facilities. This is not conversion of industrial short-term. And I think, you know, the tax boom is going to be part and parcel of the content companies looking for reasons to sort of stay close to home or close to the markets that they know are the sticky markets to continue to grow in.
Also, bringing Blackstone on board with this particular project, I assume a lot of people might be wondering if more is expected there and what kind of benefits that partnership might might bring to the table. I mean, what does that maybe change about the way that your company looks at maybe building some of this stuff out, and how big of a boost it could be for future projects?
Yeah, Blackstone's been a fantastic partner of mine for many, many years. And this is just another sort of continual relationship driver for us to, you know, move forward in this specific area. You know, their desire in the studio business on the construction side, on the existing facilities, and the overall media growth is really where that driver is. You know, our intent is to grow our portfolio collectively with them, our brand, which is our Sunset Studios brand, with them, and continually look for unique alternatives that are going to fit perfectly within our mutual desires to build that brand and build our portfolio out.
All right, Hudson Pacific Properties CEO Victor Coleman, appreciate you coming on here to chat with us about the demand there out in Hollywood. Enjoy the sunshine, man. Be well. We'll chat again soon. Well, autonomous trucking company Plus accomplished a major milestone on its road to powering the future of driverless trucks. The company completed another level 4 autonomous drive, this time on a stretch of highway in China, without any human interaction whatsoever. Not even a backup safety driver was on board, as we've seen in other level 4 tests. And for more on what it means, as the race to automate shipping heats up, happy to welcome the CEO of Plus, David Liu, joins us on the show today. And David, appreciate you taking the time. I mean, it's fascinating to watch. I kind of just watched that clip on repeat here in terms of the footage from this trip. But how big of a step was it for you all and what you've planned in terms of rolling this technology out?
Thank you for inviting me onto the show, Zach. I'm extremely excited about talking about the demo we have just done on a public highway in China. I mean, this is a key milestone for us. It shows a glimpse of the future of what the trucking could look like. You know, how do we achieve a safer, a more efficient and greener future for our society and for the transportation industry?
Yeah, and there's other companies, of course, out there. We've talked to a few of them: Too Simple, Embark, Alphabet's Waymo, even who may have accomplished level 4 tests like this. May have had safety drivers on board, but clearly a lot of companies chasing this opportunity in self-driving trucks. Some of them going about it different ways in terms of maybe doing the long haul routes all autonomous, but then still having some drivers take the shipper or the shorter shipping routes there. How do you look to tackle the problem there at Plus? What's the way that you guys are trying to solve it?
Yeah, so we take a very differentiated technology approach and approach to get to that driverless future. So what this demo have shown is a significant step forward in the industry for us to take the driver out of this particular truck. There is no teleoperators. There is no human drivers in the cabin, right? So to be able to do this, we're extremely confident about the reliability and redundancy of the truck that we demonstrate on this highway. Certainly this is just one of the first highway demo that we have shown. We're still quite a ways away from being able to deploy this technology scalably onto our public highways. So to achieve that, we require a lot of more testing miles and be able to put our technology under a much wider range of scenarios so that we can develop that level of confidence that a technology-driven truck can be safer than a human driver. So to achieve that, what we have been doing is applying our technology onto trucks with drivers in them, and to put them under real-world tests scalably. And we're looking at deploying this technology onto hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of trucks in the next few years. And on the way, accumulating billions of miles of testing experience. And by the time, in a few years, we have sufficient miles to prove out that our technology is safer than what an average human driver can achieve. Yeah, and I believe that would be the point where we can deploy this technology scalably.
Yeah, obviously it's going to come down to, regulations as well, different in different jurisdictions, but also kind of a piece that might be overlooked a little bit here is national security as we talk about self-driving technology and that piece. I mean, the test, the footage that we're showing was in China. I think about your competitor here in Embark adding some key people to their board, Elaine Chao, the former U.S. Transportation Secretary, on board there. I mean, when people think about the risks associated with this company, you guys are going through a SPAC, which I can ask about in a second. But when you think about how you guys are positioned on the regulation and national security front, what should they know about the way that you plan to tackle this problem, both here in the U.S., but also in China, and how there might be, you know, a potential problem there?
Yeah, security and safety are the number one concerns for our company. You know, we have you know, deployed a lot of technology to make sure that our technology is secure and safe. You know, now, you know, China and the U.S. are the two of the largest market in the world in terms of what transportation is concerned. So, you know, we have taken an approach where, you know, we deploy our technology to markets where there is demand, there's need, right? So, you know, our company is, you know, based in headquartered in Cupertino, California, in the center of Silicon Valley, like, you know, some of the other auto tech companies are. And we look at, you know, applying and deploying our technology all over the world, globally, in China, in Europe as well. And, you know, for any of these geographies, safety and security are, you know, top of the concern for the society as well as the regulators there.
As I mentioned, SPAC deal here looking like Q3 in terms of when it's expected to close. With Hennessy Capital Investment Trust account, there going to be a $3.3 billion valuation attached to the deal. When we talk about it, I guess, well, capitalizing you guys with $3.3 billion, when we talk about how much that helps build out what you're working on, I mean, what's the runway to kind of use some of that cash to really expedite this? As I said, a lot of companies are chasing the opportunity. How do you look to build out the operations?
While I cannot speculate on, you know, how the market regards, you know, reacts to it, and you know, how, you know, we've made a lot of disclosure in our filings, so I'm not going to speculate on any of the specifics of the deal. But what I can tell you is that we're extremely excited about, you know, going public, and very excited about our investors and markets extremely enthusiastic and positive reaction to our company and to the technology and the business momentum we have gathered. So we're looking forward to you know, further develop our technology and deploy our technology for our customers.
Well, pretty fascinating to watch that clip, regardless of where things go from here. Already some pretty serious accomplishments made on that front. The co-founder and CEO of Plus, David Liu, appreciate you coming on here to chat with us today. Be well.
Welcome back. Last week, President Biden signed a new executive order calling for up to half of new vehicle sales by 2030 to be comprised of electric vehicles. So let's talk about the future of EV. We're joined now by Scott Mercer, founder and CEO of the EV charging station company Volta. Great to have you here with us. So one of the biggest hurdles that has really been highlighted as essentially to President Biden's plan has been building up this network, this infrastructure of charging stations for these electric vehicles. How much money do you think we would need? What do you think it's going to take to really build up this infrastructure of electric charging stations so that folks don't have to get anxiety of their car running out of juice on the way to their destination?
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I think it's really at this point about acceleration. You know, electric cars are becoming less expensive to manufacture than gas cars over this decade. Electricity is already cheaper than gas as fuel. And with these mandates, now the question is really, how quickly can you build critical fueling infrastructure in the electrification system to replace gasoline?
Now, Scott, I guess I just want to ask you about the plug then right now that you need to fill there, because obviously the aspiration to get to a certain amount of electric vehicles by X year implies that you also need to have X amount of charging stations at that point as well. And I believe that the statistics, at least on your side of the business, you've got about 1,700 EV chargers right now. You hope to have 3,000 by the end of 2021. Is that going to be enough to service, or is that going to be on the road to getting enough in place by the time the White House hopes to have X amount of vehicles on the road by then?
Oh, there's a massive acceleration in the number of ports needed as we start to move towards scale adoption of EVs. But the key for Volta is we focus not on the number, the quantity of ports or the speed of the chargers. We focus on the energy we can deliver per dollar of capital we deploy and on the return that we can get from each dollar of capital we deploy, both for Volta and for our partners. So that energy delivery is key. How many gasoline-fueled miles can you replace with electrically powered miles as efficiently as possible when building the infrastructure?
Scott, how do you think that we can get consumer acceptance of a plan like this, you know, and to get folks really on board with purchasing electric vehicles and not worried so much about their ability to charge?
Yeah, I think that the vehicles need, from a consumer standpoint, to be three things. They need to be exciting or cool or something that people really are happy about. And we're seeing a massive sort of breadth of electric vehicle options out there. They need to be inexpensive, and we're watching the price of the vehicles fall over the next several years. And they need to be dependable. And that's really where building that public EV charging grid comes in. How do you put EV charging stations at locations that people can depend on? How do you put them at locations that people find convenient? So for us, really getting that infrastructure out now is the critical piece of that puzzle to focus on.
Scott, where are the areas of focus in terms of developing the infrastructure in places where it's not as developed? And I mean specifically geographically. Is it in certain rural areas? Is it in certain cities where it might be hard to find parking lots to even put these chargers? Where do you see the specific geographic areas where there really is opportunity to build it up here?
Our focus is really on locations in which we see demand from electrification over time. And the fun thing for me has been to see that shift from being a coastal strategy to being something that is national and something that is really truly about sophistication of the revenue streams you can get from charging and of scale. So for us, we think that over the next several years, as you see EVs fall below the cost of gas cars, electric vehicles drivers will be like cell phone owners or like people who use the internet. It will be truly ubiquitous and it will happen faster than you think.
Well, can I just drill down on that, I guess, because what's been interesting, I see that you're, you know, focused on maybe looking at Whole Foods or Macy's, Kohl's, places where people might be shopping and can leave their car for a little while. Is that a better strategy in, let's say, you know, more suburban areas than they would be in more urban areas? Do you feel like there's actually a tailored approach that you could have to targeting, okay, if this is an area that needs more chargers, we should target these types of businesses or locations as opposed to those?
Yeah, I think for Volta, our strategy is matching charging locations to visit behavior. So not necessarily providing the fastest charging, but putting charging out that matches how long someone is going to stay at the property. And then on creating revenue streams from that charging infrastructure that are more diverse and more sustainable than just the energy side alone. So we're looking at where people will go and what they'll do while they charge their car. We don't think you should sit in your car and charge. We think charging should really be a 5-second activity, plugging in right before you go into a restaurant, into a grocery store, into a drugstore, could be anywhere from a 20-minute session or a 10-minute session, all the way up to a 2-hour session if you're at the movie theater. We just don't think it should interrupt your daily life.
And Scott, Volta is set to go public. Can you give us any insights as to what we can expect when that happens?
Yeah, we're very excited. We're going public. The ticker for the business combination right now is SNPR. For us, the focus going forward is really on that national footprint, building out the infrastructure, and on creating a sustainable revenue base. I mean, Volta is, I think, on par or a little larger than the revenue of our two next largest charging network owner operators combined. So it is about building a sustainable business quickly.
All right, Scott Mercer, founder and CEO of Volta. Thanks so much for joining us.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance. COVID cases are continuing to rise, raising questions about how it will weigh on the return to school as students across the country wrap up the summer break. Dr. Lena Wen joins us as part of our series looking at the state of education as Americans get ready to head back to the classroom. She's also the author of Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Yahoo Finance's Anjali Kemlani also joins us for this conversation. And Dr. Wen, just so many questions to begin with here, but obviously a lot of these parents worrying about how the spread of the Delta variant may be affecting their kids as they get their backpacks ready for school. I guess just a baseline here, what is the risk as schools reopen and these kids who may not be vaccinated in most cases are possibly at risk of spreading it?
Well, first of all, great to join you today. I think it's important for us to level set and say that two things can be true at the same time. One is that it's really critical for us to get our kids back for in-person learning full time. And the second is that there is a way for us to do that safely. That said, there are also ways for us to do this unsafely, as in we know that the Delta variant is so contagious, it spreads so easily from person to person, especially among the unvaccinated. And there is definitely a risk if you have a lot of people who are unvaccinated together in an enclosed classroom for many hours a day, of course, you're going to have the risk of spread. But there are ways to prevent that from happening and to substantially reduce that risk. By this point, we know what works, and that's a combination of indoor mask wearing. It's a combination of having as many people as can be vaccinated to do so, improving ventilation, regular testing. All these are things that can and should be done. And the CDC guidance actually here is really important and very clear that it is important and we can get our kids back for in-person learning safely, but as long as we follow these mitigation measures.
Dr. Wan, Anjali here. Really great to have you back. I know that a lot of discussion has been happening about, you know, what the CDC has been saying, the guidelines have been coming out, and the state-level differences. Looking at a map, you can see just how differently this strain of the virus is affecting different states. So is there something to be said about, you know, with your experience as a public health commissioner, something that the CDC could be doing differently in order to help, you know, make the messaging maybe more straightforward while also balancing the various needs of different areas?
I think it's very challenging. And you mentioned earlier my book, Lifelines. I was the health commissioner for the city of Baltimore. I oversaw school health in Baltimore for every one of our 180 or so public schools. It is really hard. Look, I think we need to start talking about COVID-19 and the vaccine the same way that we talk about other routine childhood immunizations. At the start of school in Baltimore, every single year, there are hundreds, if not thousands of families that have not met all the vaccination requirements. They're not anti-vaxxers. They're just families that, for example, have had other priorities. They didn't get around to this. There were other things that were really important. They're not anti-vaccine, but they needed that additional push in order to get vaccinated. This is where I think mandates are really helpful. Now, I'm not saying that we need school mandates for vaccines for kids at this point, especially since kids 12 and older or 12 and younger are not yet eligible to get the vaccine. Or 12 and older, you're eligible, but 11 and younger, you're not. But I do think that there are requirements that are needed at this point. And it really is unconscionable when we have governors at this point who are saying that they're not even allowing parents to have the tools necessary to protect their own children.
That's right, Doctor. And you're particularly talking about Florida and Texas, especially come to mind right now. Florida saying that they're not going to require students to wear a mask. Texas saying that they're not required, schools not required to do any contact tracing. And if you are in close contact with someone who's tested positive for coronavirus, you can still send your child to school. So I want to ask you about that vaccine mandate. Where does that bar really lie for you then when we should start saying, you know what, schools actually do need to start mandating that their children be vaccinated against coronavirus? I mean, parents are not new to having these vaccine mandates for other diseases and for other things. And especially once that vaccine is available for children 12 and under, do we need to really start thinking about mandating vaccines for all children that are going to schools?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we need to start with vaccine requirements for healthcare workers, for individuals working in nursing homes. And we are now seeing more and more companies implement vaccine requirements because that's in the best interest of their workers and their families and their customers as well. I think we need to normalize this for adults, and we have now been giving these vaccines to hundreds of millions of people around the world. We know that they are safe and effective. And then I think also that in schools, we should start at least implementing a testing requirement. For example, we can say that everyone needs to be tested at least once a week. But if you are vaccinated, if you're a teacher or a student that's vaccinated, you can opt out of that testing requirement. That's another very important push so that we are making vaccination the easy and convenient choice. And in the meantime, testing is also a layer of protection that's really important to help to keep these schools safe too.
Dr. Wen, in your book, you talk about basically your origin story and, you know, coming from an immigrant family and your experience with public health and with public assistance. I want to ask you, just looking back so far, what we've done and how the U.S. has dealt with the pandemic, what would you say is maybe a misstep or something that we still haven't yet hit on when it comes to looking at the most vulnerable of our population?
I'm glad you mentioned the most vulnerable because COVID-19 has certainly unmasked underlying health disparities. We've seen that it's not the virus that's discriminating, as in when we see unequal outcomes among Black Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans compared to whites, when we see that people with low income are disproportionately affected by COVID. It's not that the virus is specifically targeting these groups. It's that our systems are unequal. We've also seen that unless we specifically address disparities, they're going to worsen. And so we need to, going forward, we need to do even more when it comes to vaccinations, testing, making sure that we're protecting those who are the most vulnerable. And I think another lesson coming out of all of this is how much it hurts our overall response when something that's as basic as mask wearing or vaccines become politicized. And I really worry about public health moving forward because we've seen now some state legislatures even limit the ability of health departments to respond in the future, as in if there are tuberculosis outbreaks or measles outbreaks, the public health powers of local health departments and state health departments are even more limited than before. So I really worry about the politicizing of public health and what this means for the ability of health departments to protect the people that they serve.
All right. Dr. Lena Nguyen, the public health professor at George Washington University and also the author of Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Thanks again for stopping by. Also, thank you to Yahoo Finance's Anjali Kamani for stopping by as well. The $1 trillion infrastructure bill in D.C. may be held up by, among all things, a debate over cryptocurrency. But a bipartisan agreement was just struck about 2 hours ago that may get lawmakers past the speed bump, a readout from the bipartisan group saying that they've agreed with the Treasury Department to clarify the underlying text regarding how certain cryptocurrency holdings are taxed by the IRS. So let's dive a little bit deeper into this with Hugo McDonough. He's a co-founder at Cryptograph. And I guess I just want to start things off by asking about this news, Hugo. How do you think the crypto argument has played into these discussions, and have you been encouraged by some of the clarifications that this bipartisan group of senators is hoping to propose?
Yeah, I mean, it's super important when we're looking at general regulation of this space as it emerges, and the USA is a key driver of that. And so the initial part of this process, as I've been following it quite closely, I was quite worried by the initial wording and what they were looking at in terms of the amendment, because there seemed to be a very large knowledge gap between, you know, the realities of how this industry works and the fundamentals of decentralization and sort of trying to apply a reporting standard or, you know, a regulatory tax standard, et cetera, to this space. And so, you know, when they were talking about brokers almost encompassing, you know, anything in this space, you know, we could look a broker almost being a smart contract. That's an impossible thing to implement. And smart contracts are autonomous. And so for people to be able to collect reporting information for authorities, et cetera, on that, it would never have been possible. So I've been happy to see these amendments happen and the crypto industry within the US reply back to what was being put into this bill. And I think it's positive in as far as that they're moving through trying to understand the difference between proof of work systems, proof of stake systems, validators, miners, people who are developers and contribute to open source code, and all of these different parts of the industry. And they're beginning to articulate and understand how they work with each other and, you know, where reporting standards or tax regulation is viable and where it wouldn't be viable. And so it's positive to see the movement towards that and the movement towards understanding it in more detail. And I think that that will help reducing the uncertainty that's been around for, I think, the last few days in this space, given the discussions that have been happening in the Senate.
But Hugo, I don't know how lawmakers are, you know, across the pond, but at least here in the United States, you know, we've seen some not even fully understand how Facebook works and how Facebook, you know, really earns money. And so you talk about this knowledge gap. It almost seems that if regulation can only come after lawmakers have a full and complete understanding on some of these things, we would never get regulation, not just for cryptocurrency, but for tech or, frankly, in a lot of industries. And regulation can't just not exist at all. I mean, is that really the solution here, that we need to wait for Congress to fully understand cryptocurrency in order to start some regulation on it? And is regulation going to be, do you think, a long-term headache, but really instead of just perhaps a short-term speed bump?
So I think that regulation is probably more of a short-term speed bump in my book. I think that long-term regulation for the space is sensible. I think it's a very, very, very fast growing space, and there's a huge amount happening and changing. And, you know, what we do in my company is, you know, at the forefront of a lot of that, particularly within the NFT sector. And I think that it's very important that to do it well, you really do take a step back and you understand the intricacies here, because it's very, the crypto world and things done on blockchain in a decentralized fashion is very different to how we understand what I would sort of call the legacy system today. And so I do think that they should spend a lot of time thinking about how to apply frameworks to this industry, and not just trying to, you know, sort of hit a one size fits all into it and put something last minute into a must pass bill and try and increase, you know, oversight or some regulatory system in that way. I think that's the wrong way to go about doing it. And so you're right that, you know, if we had to rely on the speed of the lawmakers, you know, things may never get regulated. But I think in the case here, it's important to take it step by step and really understand the fundamentals. And yeah, I mean, I think regulation is going to be good for the industry as a whole, and will allow for more of the early majority of people to enter this space. But it's got to be done well, and it's got to be done properly.
Hugo, I think what's interesting is that the current debate that's going on right now about infrastructure is not necessarily about the broad regulation of cryptocurrency as an entire asset class. It's really kind of zoned in on the definition of what is a broker, right? And whether or not that, by extension, that creates a government definition for proof of work versus proof of stake. But I guess without getting into the nitty-gritty of that, this brings up the question of intermediaries when it comes to people that own cryptocurrency and those that are miners, which I'm sure is transferable to a number of other crypto assets like NFTs as well. So do you feel like right now that this is an evolving space where it is still difficult to define that? Or do you think that it should be fairly clear to lawmakers, this is what a broker is, this is what a broker isn't?
I think that it's a very good question. I think that it is still fairly opaque, because a lot of intermediaries and systems that we understand today, right? You know, there's a centralized party that we can go to that will is the broker of this deal, whether it's a Forex platform or, you know, an OTC or whatever it might be, right? And in the case of the world and things like Ethereum, smart contracts can act as intermediaries. They can act as people or systems that take resource or value from one place, redistribute it, or do some kind of logic mechanism and redistribute it somewhere else. And so it looks like a broker, but it's actually a piece of autonomous code that, you know, can't be hacked, is not manipulatable, it sits immutably within the Ethereum blockchain. And so for decentralized protocols that use those smart contracts, just saying that those are brokers is not going to work, because they're something new. Where you have things like exchanges that are centralized authorities that pool, you know, buy and sell orders and have the currencies, in hot wallets and managing those inflows and outflows, they are clearly providers that you can look towards, and you can ask to do reporting and will have to come under various regulation. And the same can be said for other, you know, centralized companies that are building on top of these protocols and these layers that are offering services like that. But I think the definition of broker at one point was almost looked like they were trying to include smart contracts into that, or the definition could have gone towards that, and that would have been an impossible thing to even sort of countenance, really.
Yeah.
Because they're very different.
Absolutely. A very difficult thing when the asset class itself is always evolving seemingly by the day. But Hugo McDonough, again, co-founder of Cryptograph, thank you so much for stopping by Yahoo Finance today.